Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Later in this episode, we will learn about a global mentoring scheme that is supporting future leaders in medical physics. And we'll also find out why the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility has been dubbed the extremely brilliant source after a 150 million euro upgrade. But first, what can a grasshopper tell us about one of the most famous theorems of quantum mechanics? A whole lot, it turns out, as Physics World's Margaret Harris discovers when she chats with four researchers who have pioneered the study of the grasshopper problem.
Physics World.
If you're a regular visitor to the Physics World website, you may have seen an article we published earlier this month about a grasshopper jumping on a Bloch sphere. This article referred to something called the grasshopper problem. The basic problem is this. Suppose a grasshopper is sitting on a lawn that has some fixed area. What shape does that lawn need to be in order to maximize the chances that when the grasshopper jumps, it will land somewhere else on the lawn? It sounds like a simple question, but it turns out to be anything but. And better still, the grasshopper problem turns out to have a surprising amount to do with quantum physics, specifically Bell inequalities. Here to tell us more is a group of grasshopper problem experts. They are Dmitry Chistikov and Mike Patterson, who are both in the University of Warwick's Center for Discrete Mathematics and its Applications.
Hello, that's Dmitry.
Hi, Margaret. I'm Mike.
Olga Gulko, who's currently at Boise State University in Idaho, but is about to move to UMass in Boston.
Hello.
And also Adrian Kent, who's at the Center for Quantum Information and Foundations at the University of Cambridge. Welcome to the podcast. Adrian, can you give us a little bit of background about the grasshopper problem?
Yeah, well, this started with an attempt to understand something very different, which is the sort of detailed fine structure of so-called Bell inequalities. John Bell, back in the 1960s, gave a sharp way of showing that quantum theory behaves very different from any hidden variable theory, at least any hidden variable theory respecting Einstein's relativity. And he gave it in the form of strict inequalities. You think of some experiments you could do on two quantum particles that are entangled. And then you think, how could I simulate the results of those using classical methods? Or how could nature have simulated them using classical in variables of some sort? And the answer is, nature can't. You can't simulate them classically because of these inequalities. So inequalities give a strict bound on how correlated things can be in a certain sense classically. And quantum theory is more correlated than that. But we were interested in different ways of trying to get at the difference between classical theories and quantum theory. There's an infinite class of Bell inequalities you could look at. People have been trying to understand them for a while because it's mathematically interesting. It's also physically intriguing and potentially useful. Me and Olga, and before that, another collaborator, Damien Pitalo-Garcia, looking at a particularly simple class of Bell inequalities that we thought should be there, but that hadn't been understood so far. So the question, if you think of measuring the spin of a quantum particle, you just need to fix an axis in three dimensions, and then you ask, is it pointing along that axis one way or the other way? So if you think of measuring the spin of two particles, you have two axes, one on each side. And the question we were asking is, if you do that for a entangled pair of particles, what are the correlations between the answers when those two axes are separated by a given angle? So quantum theory gives you a very simple answer to that. And the question is, how close can you get to the quantum answer with some sort of classical simulation? How close could nature do it if nature was using classical theory, trying to reproduce quantum theory as best it could? One way of picturing a classical model of a spin measurement is, if you think of the axis that you've chosen, if you choose an axis to measure, you'll get an answer that corresponds basically to an arrow pointing one way on the axis. So if you think of all the possible axes, each one of them gives you an arrow pointing one way. And you can think of that as a coloring of a three-dimensional sphere. Wherever the arrow points, if you think of the axis going through the center of the sphere, the arrow pointing to the surface, wherever the arrow points, it's colored. Well, let's say green. and wherever it's not pointing, the opposite side, it's white. So then you have a coloring of the sphere, and half the points are green and half the points are white. And beyond that, the only constraint is that any opposite pair of points has to be one green, one white. And you can ask for any particular coloring of that type, what does that model tell you? What correlations does it give you? So that, now if you want to be picturesque about it, you can translate that into the language of grasshoppers. You think of the green bit as a lawn, and the lawn is predetermined. Nature has to decide beforehand what's going to happen for the measurements. And then you choose an axis. Well, that's going to choose a random point on the lawn. The axis will go through the lawn precisely once. Let's pretend that a grasshopper's landed at that point. And then your question is, how correlated is your answer with a measurement that's a particular angle away from that? Well, that's on the sphere, that corresponds to a particular distance. So the idea is that the grasshopper jumps a distance, and you know the distance, let's call it D, but you don't know which direction the grasshopper jumps. So effectively, the grasshopper's starting at a random point on the lawn, and it's making a jump through a fixed distance in a random direction. And whether they're correlated or not, well, that, in this version of the problem, corresponds to whether or not it's still on the lawn or not. So you end up translating the question into what shape of lawn has the biggest chance, knowing that the grasshopper is going to behave like this. It starts at a random point, makes a random jump through a fixed distance in a random direction. What lawn has the biggest chance of keeping the grasshopper on the lawn? The first place we looked in great detail was not on the sphere, but on the two-dimensional plane, which is a slightly simpler thing to look at least experimentally or computationally.
Based on that setup, it sounds intuitively like the answer ought to be a circle or maybe a disc. But I think you found out that it wasn't. That's right, Olga, isn't it?
Absolutely, and this is exactly what we thought too, that for small jumps, the optimal shape of the lawn should be round, should be a disc shape. And now, of course, for small jumps, the grasshopper can only leave the lawn if it started out near the boundary of the shape. And the disc is the shape that minimizes the boundary given a fixed area. So we were quite certain that for small jumps, the disc should be optimal. But also, it's actually quite easy to see that as the jump gets larger, then the disc can no longer be optimal because for example, once the jump starts exceeding the radius of this unit disc, then even if the grasshopper started out in the middle, it would jump out of the lawn. And in fact, if it started out in the middle, it would be guaranteed to jump out of the lawn. You could find a better shape by sort of cutting a hole into this lawn in the middle. And if the jumps are even larger than that, then say they're larger than the diameter of the unit disc, then no matter where the grasshopper starts, it will always jump out of the lawn. So for really large jumps, we could think of better shapes that are, for example, elongated, or perhaps they consist of several disconnected patches of lawn. So you can definitely think of shapes that would still yield a finite probability for the grasshopper to remain on the lawn, and that would look nothing like the disc. So our original idea was to sort of confirm that the disc is optimal for small jumps and then explore these interesting shapes at larger jumps. So we were really very surprised when we discovered that the disc is actually never an optimal solution for the grasshopper lawn. It's a very difficult problem mathematically because it's quite open-ended. So you're asking essentially out of these infinitely many shapes you can think of, which one is the best? So it's really difficult to answer it analytically. So what we did instead is we developed a numerical technique to search for and find these optimal shapes and related methods. So the idea is to start with some random configuration of these spins. And then we select a pair of spins, one spin up and one spin down, or one spin one and one spin zero. And we attempt to swap them. So turn the one into a zero and the zero into a one. And if that improves our lawn, then we always accept the swap. But sometimes we'll also accept swaps that make the lawn worse. And this is so that we can explore the configuration space of different lawns so we don't get stuck in the local minimum. And then with time, we are less and less likely to accept swaps that make the situation worse. And so eventually we should arrive at the optimal configuration. And this method is actually inspired by annealing for metals, which is a method to treat metals through a kind of heating and slow cooling process that makes them have better properties. So this method is a general optimization technique. It's a heuristic search method. So it's not guaranteed to give you the best lawn, but it's a really very, very efficient method for hard optimization problems where getting the exact solution would be really difficult, such as the traveling salesman problem, famous example. So with this method, we were able to find optimal or, you know, at least heuristically, near optimal lawn shapes for different values of the jump. And so what we found was that for small jumps, instead of having a disc, we actually have a kind of cogwheel-like shape with protrusions and indentations that resemble cogs. And the number of these cogs depends on the jump. So if your jump is very small, you have a very large number of cogs. And then as the jump increases, then the number of cogs decreases so that the distance between the cogs is approximately the length of the jump. So that was quite astonishing. And then as we increase the jump length further, so as we increase it past the radius of the unit disc, then you get, you know, a whole zoo of different really amazing shapes that are very weird and unusual. So the shapes become disconnected. They have some unusual symmetries. Actually, we found a shape that persistently came up that didn't seem to have any symmetry at all. As the jumps become larger, you get a kind of three-bladed fan configuration with additional patches around it. And then for very large jumps, we saw a kind of stripes configuration with wavy stripes that are approximately the jump length apart. And so overall, we saw at least, you know, six different classes of shapes so far. And this was really interesting and really unexpected.
Now, Dimitri, you and Mike weren't involved in the paper that Adrian and Olga wrote about the grasshopper on a 2D lawn, but I understand you've done some more recent work on a three-dimensional spherical lawn.
That's right. So maybe I should start by saying how it all started for me. So I was actually sitting in the same room at home, but I was quite unwell. And then I came across this this blog post by Sabine Hossenfelder, who is a physicist working in Frankfurt. And she just showed this very simple problem with the grasshopper and this amazing kind of cogwheels and, you know, odd shapes and what you got. And then I thought, oh, well, that's really cool. And then I just shared this with a few colleagues and people I know. And then among all these people, Mike, who is a colleague of mine here, so he got very interested and said, oh, yes, that's incredible. Let's look into this. And we very quickly realized that a very good, next thing to try and do is to actually look at the spherical version, which really corresponds to the, as I understand, the original problem that Adrian and Olga were considering. And with this version of the sphere, you've got somehow this problem that if you look at the hemisphere, then the grasshopper starts somewhere and jumps a fixed distance. It can be inside the same, on the same hemisphere or outside. But then if you change the shape of the lawn, just the constraint that the problem itself brings is somehow a bit odd, right? If you add something to the hemisphere, you know, near the equator, you know, in one place, then on the opposite place of the Earth, of the globe, you need to kind of subtract a small chunk of the hemisphere to keep it kind of symmetric, or in a sense, anti-symmetric. It's antipodal symmetry. So And then kind of incorporating that into a solution was a challenge. But the main thing was, instead of the plane, where you can kind of find an analytic solution, you know, that, well, a solution that's analytically better than, well, circle or disk on the, you know, on the plane or hemisphere on the globe. And in order to incorporate kind of nice analytic shapes, it's not very even clear what to start from, because if you change the hemispherical shapes, it's just very difficult to even approximate what the probability that the jump is, well, successful. That is, if the grasshopper kind of remains on the lawn, is good. So and spherical geometry is something that, you know, at least I had to kind of rediscover for myself, because I really only knew very little about it. And, you know, I had to find an old textbook from, I think, 1948, that spherical trigonometry, and just started reading about all these spherical triangles, you know, angles, various odd versions of, you know, very familiar things from planar geometry that look very similar, but still quite different. So, you know, the sine rule for, you know, for usual planar triangles, you have the A over sine A equals B over sine B, and so on. But here, instead of A, B, and C, you've got their sine as well, their sine function. So it's kind of a little bit more symmetric, but it's very unusual, and you need to develop the kind of an intuition for this spherical geometry as well. So this, I think, was one part that we did. And so then Mike and I worked together to, you know, to make progress towards the solution. So that's basically how it all started for us.
And I take it that there was another sort of counterintuitive result for this 3D case, just as there was for the 2D version. So the optimal solution isn't a hemispherical lawn for the 3D version, just like it wasn't a circular lawn for the 2D version.
That's right. So somehow we were inspired by Adrian and Olga's paper, and we thought, look, if they were able to show that hemisphere is that the disk is not optimal in on the plane, then we should give it a try and prove analytically that hemisphere is not optimal on the globe. So that was kind of our inspiration. And then we tried to do a few things here and there to kind of move in that direction. So that was our intuition, and it worked out, except that somehow there were quite a lot of different cases and different scenarios, and kind of depending on the properties of these numbers. So we're getting some obstacles. So we came up with some construction, but then we kind of could only apply it in a limited set of jumps. So if, I mean, to give kind of a first intuition, suppose that, you know, your jump is 2/5 of the length of the entire equator. Then you've got some pattern. But then if instead of 2/5, it's 1/5, the property can, the whole thing might just not work out. And then you're kind of, you have some solution, but your solution kind of has these, well, not holes, but, you know, you're not quite sure how much actual progress you've got. So, and this is related to just basic properties of numbers, such as whether the length of the jump is a rational multiple of pi or an irrational multiple of pi. Well, when I'm talking about pi, because I'm thinking of the kind of unit sphere where the length of the equator is just an integer multiple of pi, and then you need to kind of compare the length of the jump and the length of the equator. So, and then if the length of the jump is an irrational multiple of pi, we've got kind of a family of solutions. And then if it's a rational multiple of pi, then there are several cases, and then we characterize a set of jump lengths for which the hemisphere is optimal. But then when it's not optimal, as in the planar case, we still don't know what the optimal solution is. We are quite certain that one can do better than our solution, but how much better and what this kind of optimal solution might look like, we don't really know.
Mike, I think you wanted to add something at this point about your current best guesses.
First of all, I mean, our aim has certainly been just modest, not to find the optimal, but to come up with a mathematical proof that in cases we can define that the hemisphere is not optimal. So the precise model that we found where it was easiest to prove this was COGS, based on the work of Olga and Adrian. So we put little semicircles up and down around the equator. But because of the antipodal property, that's if a bit of the sphere is green, then the opposite part of it is white, then let me give you an example. So suppose you have a jump size of 2 pi over 7. So that would be 7 jumps would take you right around the equator. And that would satisfy the property nicely, because if you jump 7 times to get around the equator, when you're halfway around the equator, you've done 3.5 jumps, and so you're between COGS. So that's a nice, clean example, and that would be a typical case where we found it easiest to prove that this particular pattern was better than the hemisphere. But the sort of problem we come up with is that suppose you take a different size jump. Suppose you could take something like 6 pi over 17, then that works out nicely because you get 3 times around the equator in 17 jumps. So you just have to make the hemispheres small enough so you can go hopping, 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 hopping in little cogs, and you go 3 times around the equator in your 17 jumps. But suppose that you try, instead of 6 pi over 17, something close, which is 5 pi over 17, then this gives problems, because when you've gone 17 jumps, you've gone a distance of 5 pi, which of course is 2.5 times around the equator. And that lands you in serious trouble, because you've landed half the way around the equator from where you started. So you can't have a cog there, because you started on a cog and now you've ended up not on a cog. In two dimensions, you don't have this sort of constraint, and so you can just make sure that your cogs are the right distance apart for jumping. This is very, very subtle inequality that the only way we know how to tackle this is to make the cogs exactly a jump apart. And it's easy on the plane, and it's hard to maintain on the sphere, particularly because, of course, on the sphere, we don't only have to look at jumps that go around the equator, we've got to look at all jumps. So what we found was that if we got a jump size so that the size is 2 pi over an integer, then that's fine, and we can just put that integer number of jumps around the equator, and we get the kind of picture that we expect. Now, something that Dmitry mentioned was, suppose it's an irrational. So here you start from a point and you go jumping, 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 round and round and round and round the equator, and you never get back to the start point. So we want to show that in this case, which of course is the vast majority of the cases, we want to show that even in this case, the hemisphere is not optimal. So what we do there is we take tiny, tiny little cogs, tiny little semicircles up and semicircles down. And this chain of tiny little cogs goes round and round and round and round and round. We go on for a long time. We go on for a great deal number of steps. And we find that if we just stop at a suitable point, then we've already gained enough from all these little cog hops that we, even though we stop and things are a little bit awkward there, we still do better than the hemisphere. And so in all, we've finished all the cases except the one difficult case, which was where the jump is pi over an integer. And here we seem to run into trouble, and we tried everything we knew about and we just couldn't get the result that we wanted. We couldn't prove that the hemisphere was not optimal. And so when we went back to look at what Adrian and Olga and others had done, we found that to our relief, we could now actually prove that in this very special case, the hemisphere was optimal. And so we had a big sigh of relief and realized that we'd we completed this this research. And so we now know for exactly which jump sizes hemisphere is optimal and for which it is not optimal.
All right, Adrian, I'm going to give you perhaps the most difficult task of all. Can you explain what these optimal and non-optimal lawns have to do with Bell inequalities?
Yeah. Well, so what we learn is that there is a new class of Bell inequalities that almost always the hemisphere is not optimal. There must be an optimal shape. We don't yet know precisely what it is, but we can approximate it at least numerically, and we hope eventually to understand it analytically. And corresponding to that optimal shape is the best possible correlations you can get from a classical simulation of quantum correlations. And corresponding to that is a new Bell inequality. So that's true for each jump size except the special class that Mike just mentioned of pi over an integer. So that's quite exciting. That's so at least for aficionados of Bell inequalities, we've got a new insight into a different way of building Bell inequalities and shown that there's really a rich class of them. It's also interesting for people like me who think about quantum cryptography. One of the uses of Bell inequalities there is as a way of testing whether or not you're really sharing the right sort of quantum state. You want a maximally entangled quantum state shared between two parties in order to have a really secure quantum cryptographic scheme or indeed a really efficient distributed quantum computation. You could test that with Bell inequalities. In quantum cryptography, you're not just working against the thought that nature might be doing something different. You're working against the thought that there really might be an adversary out there who is trying to fool you and will do as much as they can to fool you by giving you things that they can tap into that are not quantum states, but behave as close as possible to quantum states. So the thought here that we want to explore further is because these Bell inequalities are so general and they just involve random choices of measurements, they give the adversary very little to go on. The adversary doesn't know what measurements you're going to carry out. There's no preferred axis that they can work with. And our thought is that this may be a general and perhaps more efficient way of testing for quantum signals and, say, making quantum cryptographic schemes secure than using standard Bell inequalities. It also, by the way, works. You can imagine a scenario where you have two people who are sharing quantum states, but they haven't managed to establish a common reference frame. Now, one of them knows what they call up, and another one knows what they call up. Maybe they're out in space or somewhere, but they haven't got a common frame. They could carry out the measurements now and then work later to establish the reference frame and interpret the measurements. And that would be useless if you were trying to use standard Bell inequalities, but because random measurements suffice for the sort of the new Bell inequalities we're looking at, they would work perfectly well in that sort of scenario.
I guess that opens up the question of what's next for the grasshopper and it hopping around. Where are you going to jump next?
We, of course, were delighted that the physicists came up with this beautiful problem of grasshoppers. And so we jumped, if you'll pardon the expression, we jumped on it right away and had a lot of fun dealing with this. And it was really the icing on the cake when we learned a little bit more about this, we realized that deep down it was about quantum cryptography and quantum information theory. And that's beginning to sound like computer science. So in our computer science department, we thought, wow, isn't this great? Let's have some more of that.
Dimitri, Mike, Olga, and Adrian, thank you very much for taking time to speak with us today.
Yeah, thanks very much for your interest in this work. This is amazing. We are very happy to hear that, you know, people are interested.
If this discussion has whet your appetite and you want to learn even more about the grasshopper problem, our expert panel does have a paper out about it. It's called Globe Hopping, and you can read it in the Proceedings of the Royal Society A.
Now, I'm joined by my colleague Tammy Freeman to talk about what's new on the Physics World website this week. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, Tammy, you've been looking into mentoring this week, and specifically a global mentoring scheme for early career medical physicists. Can you tell us a bit more about this program?
Okay, so this is a global mentoring program set up by Kwan Hung Ing, who's a medical physicist at the University of Malaya. Now, medical physics has got its own really specific challenges because it bridges both science and healthcare environments. So the trainees have got to learn to work and research and interact with many different types of professionals in a complex hospital environment. So Ing hoped that the mentoring scheme could provide young medical physicists with guidance and support to help them progress their career, and in particular, to help them develop leadership skills.
And so how does the mentoring scheme work? What's special about this particular scheme?
Okay, so they set it up so there was one permanent mentor, plus additional mentors from various countries and institutions who took part in discussions and provided advice. The initial group of mentees was made up of 16 people. So this is medical physicists, postgraduate students, plus an early career researcher from countries in Latin America and Asia. And then to establish relationships between the mentors and the mentees from all these different places and countries, the program used e-mentoring, which is basically video meetings, online group conference calls. So basically the things we're all using now. But this approach is particularly useful to support people in developing countries, perhaps where medical physics is just starting up and there's a lack of experienced people to guide these early career medical physicists.
And so how did it go? Is the program a success?
Yeah, so the program started in 2017 and ran until this year. And then the team has just published a research paper documenting their experiences. So at the end of the program, all of the mentees were asked to fill in an online survey. And over 80% of them said the program had had a positive impact on their personal and professional lives and said they gained knowledge and skills from the mentors. So some of the positive aspects that they described included things like increased self-confidence and less anxiety about moving to new career stages, learning to handle international meetings, improving leadership skills, and gaining a global view of medical physics. It also gave them a way to seek professional advice and learn from each other, with over half of the mentees formed research collaborations with themselves and the mentors, for example, publishing work together. Overall, the conclusion was they definitely recommended that mentoring should be implemented as an extracurricular activity wherever possible.
Wow, that sounds really useful both for the mentor and the mentee. Is the scheme continuing?
Yeah, definitely. So the team plans to expand and diversify the group with getting medical physicists from other continents to join in. So they're looking at people from Africa and from Europe. And what was interesting was that most of the mentees, so over 80%, said that they had a goal of becoming a future leader and they wanted to carry on participating in the program. So perhaps it'll be self-perpetuating with mentees turning into mentors and helping to coordinate activities in the future.
Wow, that sounds like a fantastic program. You can read more about this in an article that Tammy has written for the Physics World website. Just look for the headline, Global Mentoring Scheme Fosters Future Leaders in Medical Physics.
And Hamish, I hear there's some good news from Grenoble this week.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're always looking for good news in these sort of grim days. And yeah. This week, specifically the 25th of August, the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, or the ESRF as it's known, is up and running after a major upgrade.
So what is the ESRF?
Well, ESRF is a large electron accelerator in Grenoble, France, and it creates bright and coherent beams of X-rays for a wide range of research. anything from materials characterization to determining the structures of viruses such as COVID-19. And if you've ever been to Grenoble, you recognize it immediately. It's essentially a giant donut, and there's a ring accelerator that's surrounded by a huge experimental hall. It's really impressive sight to see.
And I guess it's even better now because of the upgrade.
Yeah, that's right. And it even has a new name or maybe a subtitle, the Extremely Brilliant Source. And it's so called because its X-ray beams now have a brilliance and coherence that are a factor of 100 better than the previous incarnation of ESRF. This was done by replacing the entire 350-meter diameter accelerator storage ring.
Well, that sounds impressive. How much did that cost?
Well, it cost 150 million euros, and the project was done in less than 2 years, which I think is pretty impressive.
And how do you think researchers will benefit from these new capabilities?
The 25th of August, that's the official opening day for our users. But, you know, because of the pandemic, scientists have already been using the new facility to do COVID-19 related research. And this has involved examining the molecular structure of the virus, as well as imaging organs that have been impacted by the disease. And so far, the ESRF has received 1,238 research proposals for using the upgraded facility. And apparently, a third of these have been granted. And some of the research, just to give you an idea of what's going to happen within the new facility, scientists are planning on mapping the human brain at the synapse level, tracking nanoparticles in soil samples, and also following lithium atoms through battery cycling. And I'm guessing there's lots of other interesting research that's going to be going on as well. You can read more about the upgrade on the Physics World website. Just look for the article, European Synchrotron Reopens Following 150 Million Euro Upgrade. And that's by our news editor, Michael Banks. Thanks, Tammy.
Thanks, Hamish.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to our guests, Dmitry Kristikov, Mike Patterson, Olga Gulko, Adrian Kent, Margaret Harris, and Tammy Freeman. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.